Good. Well, this is like getting the band back together, isn't it? Yeah. After series one of 16 episodes, here we are with series...
It's a telephone
Someone's
going.
Phone's going. Now, that is... Now, whose is that? Because if that's John's, that could be very important.
Has he gone? Where's he gone now, then?
I've no idea.
Oh, God.
I saw someone on Twitter the other day say that their landline rang and literally the whole family just didn't know what to do with themselves. They were like kids, like, freaking out over this noise that came from, you know.
Mine goes once a day at least with somebody trying to sell me something, but I just ignore it now. Never pick it up.
You join us at a critical stage of the recording of episode one of series two of Sport and the Feels. My name's Jonathan Overend. I'm alongside Sonia McLaughlin, who you've heard from, and John Inverdale, who as yet you haven't, but you will in a moment. So, welcome to this new series. We're calling it Paralympic Feels. Thank you very much if you listen to series one, part or all of it. It's still very much available for download. That ran throughout what would have been the Tokyo Olympic Games. And what happened is we got quite a bit of correspondence during that series from people asking us, would we be doing something similar during the scheduled Paralympic Games? Well, we've all worked at Paralympics in the past, and here we are. And we can't wait to bring you this second series full of really thought-provoking conversations, changing attitudes, changing perceptions, the journey travelled in the Paralympic movement, and the journey still to go. This is great sport we're talking about primarily, and we love sport, so we're back for series two. Subscribe now. Although we could do with John Songe, couldn't we?
He might just, God knows, was he gone off to answer the phone? Or was that his phone?
I think it was. He'll be with us in a few moments' time, along with Tanny Gray-Thompson, who's the first of our special guests on this second series, as we talk Paralympic Games and disability sport. And a key thing for me here is that this is sport. We're not talking about minority sports here in some patronising way that we may have spoken about disability sport in the past. We're talking about football and track and field and swimming and cycling. Are these really minority sports? Of course they're not. So let's talk about sport in this series with some incredible athletes. There are issues to debate as well, Sonia, though, aren't there? And challenges the Paralympic movement still has to face.
But how far has it come? You know, some of the early Paralympic Games, there was no crowd there. And then fast forward to London 2012 and sort of scenes that I think the Paralympic movement could only have ever thought about in their wildest dreams. Yes, there are issues, but I think London 2012 really saw Paralympic sport break through. And that there was, Rio did maintain the momentum. You know, there were some concerns that
we were a bit worried, weren't
they?
We
were,
flying out to Brazil.
Absolutely. There were concerns they were going to waste the legacy of London. But actually, the crowds came. I mean, nearly 2 million tickets they eventually sold for Rio. So it has come so far.
It has. And I was reading that Tokyo actually was on course to become the first Paralympics to sell out before the opening ceremony, before the plans, of course, had to change. Should be phenomenal once we get out there. Right, John has dealt with his business and is here. John Inverdale, how are you?
I'm very good, Jonathan. You disappeared. But anyway,
welcome.
You know, Sonia keeps talking about 2012, but if I go back to Sydney and 2000, I did the Olympics and then went on a tour around the whole of Australia, really, because I thought I'm never, ever going to do it again. And so we were in a random part, Rock something or other. I can't remember. It's Rockhampton. Rockhampton, that's right. When the opening ceremony took place. And Kylie sang at the opening ceremony. And I remember there was a big screen up that I think had been left there from the Olympics in the town square in Rockhampton. And I couldn't believe how many people, you know, thousands of people were there watching the opening ceremony of the Paralympics. And I know you'd say now, oh, well, of course they were. 20 years ago, there was no of course about that at all. And I was thinking, God, that's really interesting. Anyway, you know, we went on our merry way all around Australia. And if I have one absolute moment that I thought this is a changing of the guard, and whether it's the Australians or whatever it was specifically or whatever, we were outside Darwin, which, you know, is the middle of nowhere anywhere. So we were in the middle of nowhere, outside nowhere, and went into a bar, which was an absolutely cliched Crocodile Dundee bar in the middle of the Northern Territory.
Yeah.
And there were a load of guys in there watching a wheelchair race, and there was an Australian athlete called Louise Sauvage. Always remember her name. I mean, I confess I'd never heard of her until that evening. And this bar, full of the most archetypal ockers you could imagine, were going crazy about this woman's success in a wheelchair event in Sydney, which, you know, Darwin to Sydney is like here to Moscow. You know, it felt like it was another world, but it was very much their world. And they were really into it in a very big way. And then we kept traveling around all the way. And I can't remember where we were for the closing ceremony, but I think it was an absolute masterstroke that Judith Durham, who was the lead singer of the Seekers, who were a huge band in the 60s, and she, I don't know if she'd had an accident or whatever, but she was in a wheelchair when she sang "The Carnival Is Over" at the closing ceremony. And there were little sort of moments like that, little vignettes that you thought, picking these pieces together as pieces of a jigsaw, collectively, they are making a big difference and a big statement about disability sport. And the experience I'd had in three previous Paralympics on the periphery, that was the first time when I personally felt that this was something that mattered, and everybody involved in it realized that as well.
I mean, you were both working at London 2012. I was actually in New York at the time of the Paralympics at the US Open tennis. And I remember every evening listening to you, John, doing the live coverage from the stadium, and the sound coming out of the earphones was incredible. I mean, the noise, you know, we get used to the sound of a crowd working in sports radio. You kind of get to know it, you get to feel the decibel levels, if you like. But I'd never heard a crowd noise like that coming out of earphones when I wasn't there. And of course, the natural instinct is to flick around on the TV to find the pictures to accompany the sound that's coming out of your earphones. But because we were in the United States, and the US's approach to Paralympic sport famously has been so backward for so long, we were flicking through about 400 TV channels and couldn't find a single one showing the Paralympic Games. And of course, it transpired, Sonia, that they only showed a package of half-hour highlights about 2 weeks after the event. And that was 2012. Thankfully, things are moving now on. Better late than never. But that, to me, emphasised, you know, the challenge that disability sport has on a global basis to really sell itself.
The Americans were severely criticised for that in hindsight, particularly when we saw the success of the London 2012 Paralympics. They suddenly looked like they had really, there was a big misstep there in terms of their coverage.
Yeah.
But I remember the first morning of, I was doing the track and field, and I was actually working for Channel 4. So I was in the interview area doing the post-race interviews. And it was Alan Davis, the Welshman, who was competing in the shot put that morning. He would go on to win a gold medal in his favourite event of the discus. But this, they had finals in the morning as well, which something was a bit different to the Olympic Games. And there he was. He was the first medalist, GB medalist in the track and field. And there he was in front of 80,000 people, because so many people that couldn't go to the Olympics decided, right, I want to go and see what it's like on the Olympic Park. I want to be in the Olympic Stadium. I want to get that whole 2012 last night of the proms feel about this. And if I'll go and see the Paralympics then. And he won a bronze medal that morning, as I said, in the shot put. Oh my goodness, the noise that was created in the stadium for a bronze medal. He felt like a rock star that day. And I think it was, there were a lot of people that kind of went in curious about Paralympic sport and came out won over in terms of what they then witnessed.
Yeah, and I think that was absolutely key, what you said about Rio as well, building on 2012. It wasn't the backward step, was it? I mean, I know the crowds at the Athletics were pretty poor, but on the park, it was a vibrant atmosphere. And I remember being there every evening and just thinking, wow, this is great. Rio, Brazil, the world has really come out to support the Rio Paralympic Games. And that was great to see. And I think Tokyo will build further, won't it, Sonia?
Undoubtedly, yes. Because I mean, I remember going to the World Para Championships in Lyon in 2011.
The IPC
and
Athletics.
I tell you, yeah. Yes. And there was nobody there, Jonathan. I mean, this was 1 year out from London 2012. Mm. And I think the onus is on us to remember just how far it's come in a very short period of time. And I feel certain that Tokyo will do the same. It's a, you know, I was there for the Rugby World Cup. It's a fast-paced, colourful, bright, move, you know, city. It has a global feel about it. I think it will embrace the Paralympics. The Japanese, you know, they embraced a Rugby World Cup, which was a new thing for them. We were terribly worried about the Rugby World Cup. Were people going to turn up and watch the games? And they threw themselves behind it with a, you know, they just went for it. So I think the same thing will happen. I'm sure of it for the Paralympics.
The only thing I would say is that depending upon who the prospective host cities are for the Olympics and Paralympics in years to come, where there's a diminishing pool of cities who are realistic contenders to do that, they might be in countries where a willingness to embrace disability is not uppermost in those countries' agendas. And that's when I think the Paralympic movement might actually have an issue to deal with. That won't be the case for another decade or so, but who's to say what the future might hold there?
Right, let's bring on our first special guest then to this second series of Sport and the Fields. And it's hard to think of a better known British Paralympian. 11 gold medals in wheelchair racing. Such an advocate for disability sport and disability rights. So many hats on in different areas of society as well. It's Baroness Grey Thompson, or to us, Tanny Grey Thompson. Let's get her on the pod. Well, Tanny, thanks so much for being with us. I mean, we're talking remotely, as we have done throughout all the series that we've done so far. And I suppose this, with your various hats on, is your life at the moment, isn't it?
It is. I mean, I never thought I'd be talking about doing House of Lords online. And so it's like, I mean, in a place that hasn't really changed in 600 years, within 2 weeks, we're all sort of doing online calls and debates. So I have to say the only thing is my dress code has dropped quite a lot. So I've gone back to, you know, like living in training kit and hoodies. And I've had to have a few times where I've suddenly realised it's not appropriate House of Lords outfit. So I've kind of had to hide the fact I am wearing. I've been trying to stick the hood of my hoodie down the back. I mean, it's really not very ladylike at all on so many levels.
Well, I mean, is there any code at all here? I mean, what are your colleagues doing? Are they rocking up in their full regalia?
Oh, well, the dress code is, I describe it as posh funeral, which is kind of smart and dark and quite dignified. I don't think a hoodie and training tights and a pair of trainers quite match. But you know, these are strange times, so it should be about the quality of the debate, not about what you're wearing.
You always make me laugh, Tanny, because you're a woman who, like me, suffers in the cold. And I just can imagine when we had that really awful hot spell. For once, you weren't cold, right?
Well, I had one night where I didn't take my hot water bottle to bed with me. But I did, you know, I took my hot water bottle and a kettle to Rio with me. So it's a shame you can't see it because it's actually sitting next to me on my desk right now.
Is it really?
So,
I knew it would be.
Yeah, it's not good, is it really?
Here's what I want to know about the whole Zoom call life, Tanny. You're on the BBC board, you're in the House of Lords, you're on all sorts of other boards as well that I'm sure some we even don't know about. Have you ever mixed up a call yet? Have you clicked on the wrong invitation at the wrong time?
No, I've joined a meeting that I wasn't meant to be at, and so I kind of guess it was clicking it at the wrong time. So, but I realised I wasn't meant to be there and exited very quickly. So luckily they weren't being rude about me. So I think I got away with that one.
All right, John's here as well. It's a new world, John, isn't it?
It is a new world. Also, what's a new world is the way over the last, you know, if we go back to the Paralympics, I was just remembering the first Paralympic experience I had, which was in Seoul in 88. I wasn't actually at the Games, but I stayed on after the Olympics and got sent to do a piece about the Olympic Village in the immediate aftermath of what everybody said was the big party going home and leaving, you know, the after the Lord Mayor's show. And boy, it sure felt like that. It seemed like they were dismantling everything around us, piecemeal almost. And you almost felt that if you tapped somebody on the shoulder and said, do you realise there are several thousand more people about to arrive for a big international sporting event? They were going to go, really? And so it's extraordinary in 30 years, 30 plus years, how things have changed out of all recognition. I'm sure Tanny knows that better than anybody.
I mean, John's right about Seoul. I mean, it was fascinating because they kind of did rent a crowd. So the government had got people to come in to fill the stadiums. And one day they'd be supporting, you know, GB and have Union Jacks, and the next day they'd be supporting Germany and kind of completely ignored us. So, I mean, basically a crowd's a crowd. So, you know, you shouldn't ever be too fussy about that. I think for me, a big change took place in Barcelona. And, you know, Helen Rollison was there covering it, and, you know, she did some amazing work on the games. And there was a massive crash in the men's 5,000-metre final. I mean, literally, going into the bell, everybody apart from the winner got wiped out. And I remember having a conversation with her and her saying, should we show it? And I was like, yeah, absolutely, that was amazing. And that was the first time, you know, sport was shown. It wasn't... So some of the stuff around Seoul was a little bit patronising. But, you know, if that had been cycling or any other sport where there was this massive crash, it would have been straight on the TV. And apparently it was one of the most requested things to watch. So for me, that was the point where you go, actually, this has been shown as sport and not much else. And then each Games has been a step... You know, London was obviously incredible, but there's been a step forward with each sort of four-year cycle.
How important, Tani, do you think television's engagement has been with changing the whole perception of the Paralympics? Because, I mean, you say that things improve with Barcelona, but my recollection of Atlanta was that the Americans were almost wished that it hadn't taken place.
I mean, they really didn't want us, so they were dismantling the village around us because the Olympic village is bigger than the Paralympic village. And I'd been at the Olympics because we'd had a demonstration race there, so you could see the difference between the two games. I mean, there were days in the Atlanta Stadium where I could pretty much name the crowd. It was that bad. But, yeah, that wasn't a high point. But actually, I think how British media covered it made a big difference. And I certainly remember, you know, even into Athens and Beijing, talking to American athletes where they watched the BBC coverage of the Games because they got more information from that than they did from anything back in the USA. So I guess, you know, we know we've truly hit it when it's live in the US. And, you know, we're making big steps there. But certainly, I think the people and the journalists who covered it made an important, you know, part of it. Because, you know, when Helen Rollison passed away, then a lot of her mates, so John, you know, Claire Balding, lots of other people were like, OK, we're going to sort of step into the mantle of Helen. And it was the individuals that then had that big impact on the TV coverage, which was really important for us. Because if it's not on TV, then, you know, literally people, you know, it doesn't get to the number of people we need to get it to.
How much, Tani, did Channel 4 take it to a whole new level in London with the Meet the Superhumans campaign? Because I remember that resonated so clearly. It was bold, it was brash, the music was loud, and suddenly here were Paralympic athletes being viewed as rock stars.
I mean, the whole of 2012 was just a whole new level, and you know, there were sort of various iterations of their campaign. Their first one, which was Freaks of Nature, which was a bit complicated in terms of disability rights. But when you look at the not just the sports programming that came out of Channel 4, but things like The Last Leg, I mean, that stood the test of time. And they were able to do things in a way I think other channels couldn't, in terms of questioning, you know, the is it okay hashtag. And they were talking about impairment and they were kind of joking about stuff in a way that I think that's been a really important part of, if you can say, normalising impairment and disability and taking it forward. Because actually, you know, amongst disabled people, there is a lot of humour. I mean, you wouldn't say you're laughing all the time. And there's a lot of difficult stuff as well. But you kind of need to find the humour in some of those situations as well. So, I mean, it'd be interesting, you know, who knows what's going to happen with Tokyo. But I think we were all really hoping, because the Japanese do have quite a strong tradition with the games, and certainly in certain sports, that it would kind of build on Rio and take it to yet another level in terms of coverage.
Tani, chicken and egg question. How much have the Paralympics, do you think, affected society's approach to disability? And how much has society's changing approach to disability enabled the Paralympics to flourish?
Oh, gosh, that's a difficult one. I mean, there's a few people who say 2012 changed the world for disabled people, and I sort of dispute that, because at the same time in the UK, disability hate crime against disabled adults and children doubled, and you've got austerity and, you know, lots of challenges. I'd say 2012 changed the lives of a number of Paralympians, and it's important to show that, you know, disabled people can do lots of things. I guess young disabled people are constantly being told that they can be a Paralympian, you know, should you be a Paralympian, and they're not necessarily being given, you know, some of the other opportunities or some of the other things they can do, like be a lawyer or a teacher. So Paralympics are seen as a really natural thing to do, but there are still lots of barriers towards disabled people being in employment. But you kind of need both. I mean, to be honest, we don't expect the Olympics to change the world, although there is, you know, the sort of, you know, countries aren't meant to be trying to kill each other during the Olympics. But we sometimes have a higher expectation of the Paralympics that we're going to fix all the ills of society. But then you look at what it's done in China, in, you know, other countries where they didn't really engage in the Paralympics and then suddenly realised they needed to. That, again, that's changed the world for Paralympians. They basically turned children's homes into training camps, and have given recognition, not to every disabled person in China, but to sort of to many disabled people who wanted to do sport. So, yeah, it definitely helps, but you can't expect the Paralympics to fix everything.
One of my abiding memories of Sydney Paralympics, inevitably, was the Spanish basketball team, who were not disabled, but it was decided that it was very important to get a medal, so therefore we're going to put able-bodied people into the team. There was a moment there where you really, when you read that or you saw it, you really did have to sort of look at it again and again and again, think, have we really stooped to that kind of level where medals on the Olympic stage or any international stage are that important? You must have witnessed that with absolute, well, A, disbelief, and B, horror, surely.
Yes, absolutely, because, I mean, I think some of it, you know, that there are people who'd sort of, actually, it was a couple of journalists who kind of got through the system. So I think one of it showed up that the classification system needed to be really robust, and that's sort of an evolving process. But you look at on the Olympic side as well, you know, how much medals mean, you know, to countries like Russia, where there's been the state-sanctioned doping, and countries, you know, and individuals will try and push the boundaries as far as they possibly can. So that's why you have rules. You have anti-doping rules, you have classification rules, you know, and there's always more that needs to be done in terms of making sure people... And having appropriate penalties for people who... and countries who cross the line. But there's... this probably sounds a bit wrong, but it kind of shows how important the Paralympics is, that there are people who are willing to break the rules. It's never good that people are willing to do it, but I think, you know, having China and other countries now stepping in and it being part of their soft politics and their global ambitions to, you know, the Olympics and Paralympics probably still don't have equal status, but that status is becoming more equal with each passing year.
You're listening to Sport and the Fields, episode 1 of series 2. I'm Jonathan Overend, alongside Sonia McLaughlin and John Inverdell, and we're in conversation with Baroness Gray Thompson, Tanny Gray Thompson, winner of 11 Paralympic gold medals. Don't forget to check out series 1 if you haven't heard it already, focusing on the Olympic Games. But if we rewind to Atlanta 1996 and the Paralympics Tanny said the Americans didn't want, I was interested in her feelings then, at the time, about the future of the Paralympic movement. She said she could name virtually everybody in the crowd, so she must have had fears about the future.
I think there's that balance between the reality you're living as an athlete in the village and seeing everything that was going on, and, you know, the food was awful. But, you know, the Olympics, they'd had problems where athletes had missed the event because the bus drivers had gone the wrong way, and... you know, that there were other sort of security issues at the Games. I mean, even if you take the city centre sort of bombing out of it, which was, you know, really quite scary for the athletes that were there. Atlanta's Olympics wasn't brilliant. And then actually what most people remember is that Redgrave and Pinsent won the only sort of gold medal. And people forget about all the other stuff. I think people sort of sometimes forget the Paralympic team did pretty well. But at that point, we were overshadowed. But if you looked at the coverage at home, which was nightly, you know, was really positive, lots of journalists, you know, written journalists were there, that showed a different side of it. And the public appetite was really welcoming. So it's always a bit weird being in the village because it's not the real world. But you have to balance that with how everyone else see it. So I think even at that point, I was eternally optimistic because the public were engaging. So even if the organisation's not what you'd want it to be, the fact that the public was starting to care about the Games really made a difference. And I remember coming home from Atlanta and, you know, the people had come to the airport to kind of welcome us home. And, you know, that felt that a really positive side out of a games that, you know, wasn't the best games to be
so
at.
So that's really interesting, that the public perception, the outside world, if you like, was almost more important to you then in terms of seeing the future than what you were seeing in America. And then, Sonia, as you mentioned a while ago, 2012 happened, and it just felt like, you know, the whole thing exploded, and Paralympians were stars, and it was the tone, as Tani said, the tone of the coverage, which was almost as important as the blanket live coverage, wasn't it? You were involved in it.
Yeah, I mean, I was very lucky to work for Channel 4 on 2012 Paralympics, so I was party to some of the conversations and the meetings in the build-up to that. And I mean, I freely admit, I was terrified. I'd never worked on Paralympic sport before, and I was just... The biggest thing for me, Tani, was I was just terrified I was going to say the wrong thing. And, you know, I just thought, what do I do to avoid putting my foot in it? Because I just thought, I don't want to be that person who just is the one who's vilified for saying the wrong thing at the wrong time. And I think what was great about Channel 4's coverage was that they were unafraid. They were just determined that they were going to break down barriers. They were going to show that these weren't disabled people. They were wonderfully able. And I just think that they burst into people's living rooms and went, here, have a look at this. Here is a man with dwarfism and he's throwing a javelin. Here's a man with one leg and he can jump. He's in the high jump and he's brilliant at it. And suddenly you were looking at people who previously you would have probably caught yourself staring at and wondering about. And I certainly, for one, found that I was looking at people and looking at disability in a very different way. And I suddenly didn't see a wheelchair anymore. I just saw the athlete. I didn't see an amputee anymore. I saw fantastic blade runners. Were you conscious of people having that same thought process, Tani?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, certainly from, you know, the sort of the daily feedback or, you know, leaving, you know, the park every night and talking to people on the tube. I mean, I think there was some really smart stuff in terms of it was a single organising committee. You know, Olympic tickets went on sale first, so built this huge demand. And then people, you know, the sale of Paralympic tickets was amazing. But then you've got moments like, you know, Johnny Peacock, where, you know, he silenced the crowd before his 100-metre final. You just don't see things like that. And it definitely helped. The buzz of the Olympics kind of feeds then into the Paralympics. And I remember leaving the stadium the night that Johnny Peacock won his 100 and talking to a young family. And the little girl had meningitis and she'd become a double-leg amputee, and she was there walking a little prosthetic leg. She was about, I don't know, 6 or 7. And her mum had said at the beginning of the games that she hadn't really wanted to show her legs. And then she'd made her mum go out and borrow a pair of shorts so that everyone could see that she was a double-leg amputee. And I'd said to her, you know, what do you think of Johnny? Wasn't it amazing? She was like, yeah, it was really good. And I said, you know, do you maybe want to be like Johnny when you grow up? You know, I'm saying about, you know, only telling disabled kids they can be Paralympians. Then I'm saying to this girl, do you want to be a Paralympian? And she looked at me, she went, don't be stupid, I'm a girl, he's a boy. And you go, right, you've been put in your place, Tani. But you know, she, for families, it was this amazing thing. And, you know, the adverts around the city and, you know, suddenly there were a number of Paralympians who became household names. You know, and watching Dave Weir win 4 goals, you know, in my sport. I mean, that was, some of the best sport I've ever seen, where David just had this aura about him where he could have won the races in any way he wanted. And that doesn't happen often in an athlete's career. And it was amazing just seeing, I mean, it wasn't effortless because, you know, it's not, but he just was in that zone where it was going to be a given that he was going to win 4 goals. And those sorts of things, you know, that's what makes it. It was sport. It wasn't disabled people. It wasn't these poor disabled people. It was really amazing elite sport.
But the thing is, Tani, and you know, for all the fact that we are 100% with you on the way that the growth of the Paralympic movement has been exponential, nonetheless, when the flame goes out at the end of the Paralympic Games, it does feel as though the flame goes out for disability sport for the next 4 years. And there may be world championships and there may be events all over the place, but they don't resonate in the same way. And that's one of the great issues and one of the great problems, if you like, that the Paralympic movement or the disability sport in general has to confront.
It is, and in terms of, you know, should there be a greater push like with 2017 World Athletics, we had the mainstream then disability event. Should there be closer integration at World Championships to kind of drive that change? Some of it's around sponsors, media coverage. It's about where athletes, you know, choose to compete as well. So, you know, I think Commonwealth Games has been quite smart. We couldn't have a parallel Commonwealth Games, but picking up events, and there's a huge debate about which events should or shouldn't be in the Commonwealth Games. You know, that's a step forward. But I tend to think it's a little bit like the Winter Olympics, and I'm guilty as most people, is that the Winter Olympics come around, I go, oh my, this is the most amazing thing ever. You know, I'm going to, you know, and pick any one of the sports. You know, this is incredible. I'm going to watch it like full on for the next 4 years. And then I don't. And so that there is a need to have, you can't just rely on London Marathon and the Great North or Wimbledon wheelchair tennis. It needs more coverage in between. But then we're competing against lots of other sports. I mean, the whole debate during lockdown about where women's sport fits, you know, that's kind of true around disability, is where are the slots? Without more people watching, you don't get the sponsor, and it's this sort of decreasing circle. So, you know, now is maybe a time, you know, as we've kind of figured that we can do stuff with technology, that there's maybe different ways and different platforms that we can use to show some of this sport. You know, because I've been to World Championships, Sonia has, you know, athletics championships where, you know, the numbers aren't there. You know, when we're in, you know, Qatar and things, it's a real struggle. So, you know, it's this probably is me sort of pushing it back onto the IPC to say, you know, how much further do you want to take it? How much more, you know, do you want to invest in it? Because it can't be something that's once every 4 years, because it won't have the longevity. It needs to be something that people care about. People need to either want you to win or want you to lose. It doesn't really matter which one, but they've got to care in between, you know, the games every 4 years.
The other very live issue at IPC headquarters, of course, Tanny, is the whole classification debate, which will always happen, because obviously athletes have to be categorised depending on their impairment and their level of impairment. And here we hit really grey territory, don't we? And you know as well as anyone the chatter that goes on behind the scenes, the athletes who feel they are downgraded, the athletes in certain cases who are now not even able to compete at the Paralympic Games, even though they feel there is no home for them. Where are we with this whole debate? Is there an obvious solution in your mind, or will this rumble on forever, do you think?
There's been a big review of world swimming. You know, basketball's been more in the news lately in terms of, you know, their reviewing it. I think, I mean, it is difficult because people will fit one side of the line or the other, but it probably has
to. And there has to be a cutoff somewhere, yeah?
There does, because, or you know, you kind of open disability sport to anybody. But actually, the reality with that people with really high level impairments will not be able to compete. I mean, kind of have to remember that Paralympics came out of discrimination because mainstream sport didn't know what to do with us or didn't want us. So there has to be rules around it. But we probably have to move a little bit more towards the anti-doping rules, because if an athlete changes class, whether it's intentional misrepresentation or they've just been wrongly categorised, there's not really any kind of penalty around it. So, you know, at the moment, there's national structures, there's international structures. It is evolving. And actually, it's for the athletes who don't win the medal because somebody's in the wrong class, or they don't even get to compete at the games because they didn't fit into the system, not because they're not classifiable, but because someone who's in the wrong category has been put in front of them. There needs to be a lot more work. It will never be perfect, just as anti-doping's not perfect. But this, to me, is a potential real threat to the games. If it's not sorted, because what the public want to see ultimately is competition that's as fair as it can possibly be, and you need to kind of have some faith in what you're watching. And it's really contentious and it's really difficult, and you know, it's a bit like sort of other areas of sport. There's a number of athletes, you know, it's really difficult to speak out on this because, you know, athletes are shut down and aren't really allowed to have opinions. So this pushes back to the IPC again and to the International Federations of Sport. Is they have to just make sure that they're above board in terms of every single point. I mean, for me, I think one of the issues is you shouldn't be classifying athletes when they're very young or they're very new, because if it's very soon, say post-trauma, post-accident, it can take a couple of years for the impairment to settle in. Or if you're a disabled child who hasn't had access to PE in schools, you may not have hit your potential. So it shouldn't be time-banded, it should be on your impairment. And that's where we need really, really good people doing the classification to make sure it's as fair as possible.
Isn't one of the fundamental problems that the IPC have, though, that if you had a category in every discipline for every disability, the games would last a month and a half. And you also don't want to have 8 different 200-meter categories, because then the watching public find that very, very hard to, A, comprehend, and B, appreciate, because they think, well, we're almost giving gold medals to everybody. And yet, on the other hand, you've got to be as fair as you possibly can be to every kind of disability that there is. And that's a very, very hard square to circle, isn't it?
It is difficult because, you know, there's been comments sort of previously, I remember especially around swimming, which I'm not an expert in, where there was a Chinese athlete who was amputated through the shoulders swimming against someone who's a paraplegic, and lots of debates about, well, how's that fair and how's it... And so, you know, I think there's been a lot of effort to try and make the system work. You could debate how successful it's been in some sports. But yeah, you're right, you can't have, you know, 50, 200 metres, because you kind of slightly lose the excitement. You know, and if I look at my sport, wheelchair racing, you know, men's wheelchair racing is a really deep sport. And what they've had to do is move away from having heats and semis and finals to try and just take maybe the top 10 or top 12 in the world. So even getting to the Paralympics is incredibly difficult in some sports, where you could argue in other disciplines it's not as hard because the numbers aren't there. But so I think there's a lot more that has to be done in terms of developing different categories, and whether those events might be at a World Championships or a Europeans. But, you know, in the Olympics, you know, you have to have so many people from so many countries and so many continents competing. It's maybe that has to evolve a little bit more. So you could maybe have more events at a Worlds and less events at Paralympics. And there'll be people who, you know, be upset if they're left out. You know, my 200 metres in Athens got cancelled. You know, they decided quite early on not to have it on the programme. And my option was I compete upper class or I just don't do the 200. And a number of 53 in my classification chose to compete up. So, you know, it's not easy. But for the public... and this is where, you know, I think Channel 4's done a good job trying to explain how the different groups fit together. The public want to see good sport. And the reality is, there's lots of Olympics that's not good sport. And there's, you know, it's not good sport because it's disabled people. It's sometimes there are events which are not very exciting. And I think what they're trying to do is make each event as exciting as possible. But, you know, there's probably a million committees sitting. That's a bit of an exaggeration, but, you know, arguing and debating this and trying to make it as good as possible.
I suspect you're on them all, aren't you?
No, I try not to be.
You should be. I mean, that's kind of the next question.
I try not to sit on too many sports committees.
Well, I mean, are they missing a trick somewhere, Tanny, in your opinion? I mean, is there one thing that you would do if you were right at the top of the IPC right now?
Ooh, that's probably a different question if I was leading British sport to if I was leading kind of world sport, to be honest. I think they've got to be pushing really hard for countries to do meaningful sports development of events for disabled people and make sure that people have the opportunity actually to be not very good at sport. You know, what we've seen over the years is there's a bit more of a stepladder than a pyramid. And this is true in the UK as well, is that, you know, I still have disabled, you know, children write to my parents, write to me saying they're not able to do PE in schools, or, you know, with quite limited talent ID days. You can't just decide if someone's talented in one day. You know, if you look at Dave Weir competed in Atlanta when he was 16, and hit his peak maybe in 2012. You know, he's coming back again. He's really strong at the minute. So it's not in across all sports where in just one or two years you can suddenly be really good and winning world medals. So we actually need just to have lots of disabled people who aren't very good at sport but feel that they have a place and are able to compete and take part and have fun and be a bit rubbish. And at the moment we haven't quite got that right. And, you know, that's something I think certainly in the UK we could do a lot of work on to make sure that people have the opportunity to be physically active and to play sport.
Did I hear you right? Did you say Dave Weir's coming back?
He's training, yeah. He's doing really well at the moment, apparently, yeah. So he's going to be taking part in the London Marathon. He's doing really well. So I think he just needed some time. Whether he comes back to race on track is something different. But, yeah, he's still got a really good couple of years in him. If his head's in the right place and he wants to train, he could still do really, really well.
Watch out, world. Watch out, world.
No.
Look, we'll wrap this up in just a second. I just wanted to ask you as well, one of the themes of this particular series, I think among the people we're going to be talking to, Liz Johnson's coming on, we're going to talk to Claire Boarding, who I know has got strong feelings on this as well, Tanny. The whole idea that the workplace, employment in the UK, has still got some way to go until it's where it should be in terms of recruitment of disabled people. What lessons can big corporations learn from the Paralympic movement?
Absolutely. I mean, in terms of the legislation I work on, this is one of the main areas. I mean, the employment gap for disabled people is twice the national average. When we talk about gender pay gap or Black, Asian and minority ethnic pay gap, we don't talk about disability pay gap because there's not generally enough disabled people in the workforce to be able to kind of work out what the gap is. So there's lots. We don't see as many disabled people in different parts of society as we should. And, you know, the fact that if you look at the film industry, it's still completely acceptable. We call it cripping up, which we can because we're disabled, where, you know, a non-disabled person plays a disabled character. You know, in some cases, maybe if you're playing Stephen Hawking, that's okay. But, you know, it's for a lot of us who are disability rights campaigners now, it's not acceptable to keep just having non-disabled people playing the parts. And I got into a bit of a Twitter discussion with whoever runs Dwayne Johnson's Twitter feed, it might have been him or not, where he tweeted something which said his last film, Skyscraper, where he plays an amputee, where he hoped it was going to open the, you know, the media for more disabled actors. And my response was, well, why didn't you employ a disabled actor in a film rather than pretending to be one? And I think that was seen as being a bit edgy. But, you know, we don't see that many disabled people in film, just as characters, just in the background, just not having anything related to their disability, but just being a character. And so, you know, a lot of disabled people...
That's why it was so cool to see Liz Carr in Silent Witness, wasn't it?
Amazing, you know. And I think there was one episode in everything that she did which was about impairment, and the rest was her just being really good at her job. And so, yeah, we need to see more stuff like that. And not just in the Paralympics, it needs to be everywhere. So... yeah, if we're not going to do stuff now... I mean, a lot of disabled people for years have been asking for working at home. It wasn't possible. And then a bunch of non-disabled people, because of COVID, wanted to work from home, and it happens. So we need to take the best. And it's been really difficult. You know, quarter of people who've died from COVID have been disabled. You're 11 times more likely to die from COVID if you're disabled than non-disabled. So we kind of need to take the best of what's happened during the pandemic and make sure we give disabled people a chance to be... you know, working wherever it is, but in employment.
Did Dwayne ever get back to you on that one, Tenny?
We had a bit of a discussion for a while, and then it fell silent from his side. But you know, you never know. You never know. It might have got through to him that I'm looking forward to his next film. I mean, none of them are very believable, but him playing an amputee was really not believable. You know, 100 foot in the air where the rope gets caught around his prosthetic leg and it didn't fall off. Seriously, guys, that's good. But, you know, I mean, it's not... We'll see. We'll see if I've had any impact on him whatsoever. I think possibly not.
Tanny versus The Rock. I know who my mate is on.
Tanny, we'll let you get on. There is a committee meeting room calling for you, I'm sure, somewhere.
Thank
to put
you.
The hoodie on.
Thank you very much.
So there we go, Tanny Gray Thompson in her hoodie off to the I loved that image of Tanny Gray Thompson in her hoodie with all the old duffers of the House of Lords. Brilliant stuff. If anyone can pull that off, Tanny can.
What a fantastic ambassador she is for disability sport, though. She's just so bright and she's achieved so much, and she cares so passionately about the future of Paralympic sport.
Every time you hear her speak, John, you feel like you should be in charge here. You should be in charge of whatever you're talking about, no?
The thing that never ceases to amaze me about Tanny is her enthusiasm. I mean, she is the proverbial Duracell bunny, and she throws herself into everything. And I remember the first time I ever met her was doing a TV piece for her on the filthiest night imaginable in Cardiff, when it was, you know, the proverbial cats and dogs. And she was out there training, putting the hours in, And she was unremittingly cheerful because she was a mission. She was on a mission and she was determined to achieve it. And you kind of feel that however many committees and subcommittees and super subcommittees she's on, she takes that same positivity and that same, damn it, we're going to get something sorted here approach, which I think is why she is, you know, as she is, such a great ambassador for not just actually for disability sport, but I think for this country as well. And whenever you spend time in her company, you come away enthused and positive and say, yeah, we can do that. She is one of the ultimate can-do people.
Indeed. Thank you, John. Thank you, Sonia. And most of all, thanks to Tanny Gray-Thompson with her 11 gold medals, her hoodies in the House of Lords, and her trashing of Dwayne The Rock Johnson on Twitter. Well, if there's ever a rematch there, as Sonia said, there's only one winner in our minds. So thanks for your company. That was episode 1 of series 2 of Sport in the Fields. We're here throughout the scheduled Paralympic Tokyo Games, and we'll see you next time.
Sport in the Fields is a 94/19 independent production.